So as we are starting to move toward the latter part of the retreat, I think it's helpful to remind ourselves that it ain't over yet. and to keep our attention, reflection going, not in a frantic way or desperate way, but just recognizing that we have all the conditions available to us to use our time skillfully and allow the benefit of the practice to show itself, to manifest. I've been using the structure of the Buddha's discourse on mindfulness and breathing as a basis for the majority of the teachings I've been giving. And I mean, it's interesting. I wasn't really planning on that, but it's what seems to be useful or relevant for some reason. And just reflecting that this mindfulness of breathing is not just about how do I pay attention to my breath as it comes in, goes out, but to expand the perception and understanding of the use of the breath as a means of plugging into the four foundations of mindfulness, which the Buddha is very explicit in saying that these the application of these four foundations of mindfulness is the direct way for the realization of freedom from suffering. Also that mindfulness of breathing is not just a meditation technique, but it's a way of incorporating our practice of the Dhamma to encompass the whole path that the Buddha lays down of sila, samadhi, panya, of virtue, of meditation, of wisdom and discernment. So that as we lift up the attention to the experience of the breath, just to recognize that we are engaging in a larger, there's a bigger picture going on here. We can use the breath to really hone in on and really try to focus attention. But it's the result is also applicable to our life in general. It also highlights certain aspects of, say, maybe difficulty or obstruction that we experience, and so we get to learn from that. So I think what is this called? Scale invariance. And you do something on a small scale, and its relevance or application is also applicable in the bigger picture. I've been going through the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness and breathing in a sequential way, because you have to start somewhere. And when you use language, then you. It's helpful to sort of begin speaking at the start of a sentence rather than starting at the end. People can understand you better. in terms of actual practice, we can pick up mindfulness of breathing at any point, any juncture, can move around within those 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing and see what works for us, what is interesting, what's helpful. So that even though I have been beginning at step one and been working through towards step 16, it doesn't have to be a linear application when we're practicing. On the last day that I spoke on the mindfulness of breathing, I've been discussing the last section, which is the section on dhammas or on phenomena, and contemplating impermanence, I breathe in, contemplating impermanence, I breathe out, contemplating dispassion, I breathe in, contemplating dispassion, I breathe out. And then it goes on to contemplating cessation, I breathe in, contemplating cessation, I breathe out. And cessation, the Pali word is nirodha, so that the most common translation is cessation. So to be paying attention to endings. It's interesting that I mentioned in regard to, say, the contemplation of dispassion, that in the Girimananda Sutta, the Buddha defines or encourages the contemplation of dispassion as this is peaceful, this is sublime, this is the that is the ending of all formations, the relinquishment of all underlying substrata of existence, nibbana. And in that discourse, the next contemplation is also contemplation or recollection of nirodha, of cessation. And it's exactly the same. I've always been curious why. It makes sense that it's the same, but there isn't any difference at all in the phraseology. So that contemplating cessation. Yeah, this is peaceful, this is sublime. This ending of our entanglement with conditioned phenomena. And just being able to pay attention to what is peaceful. I think in some senses, the contemplation of cessation is, it has a stark quality to it in the sense of, and this is where sometimes these Buddhists, they're so negative. But whatever has the nature to rise, it's going to cease. So that cessation is bound up with all arisings. Anything that arises will cease. So that there's a having to come to grips with the ending of the things that we are attached to, that we have invested our, say, emotional ties with, and to be able to put that into the picture, because there is in much mythology, all these disasters happen, but then all of a sudden you get it all back again. Everything's just fine and dandy, and everybody lives happily ever after. And the Buddha is not quite that reassuring. But the Buddha is pointing to something else also, in that the seeds of our liberation and peace are in the endings of things, when we're willing to really look closely. It's like there's a, it's sort of similar, sort of related in the sense. There's a discourse where, as is the case in the Deva Samyutta, the connected discourses on the Devas, and sometimes these Devas come and either with a question or with an understanding, and they want to test their understanding with the Buddha. And the Buddha sometimes approves of their understanding as a way of encouraging. But then also the Buddha will kind of correct or tweak their understanding so that it's more in line with Dhamma. But there's a discourse where a deva comes and basically speaking about the impermanence of life, the cessation of our existence, and being driven on to old age, sickness, and death. And because of that, we should do what's good, what's wholesome, and sow the seeds of our happiness, which is certainly a part of the Buddha's teachings. But in this particular discourse, the Buddha repeats the kind of refrain of the world is, and our life is driven on by old age, sickness, and death. It's swept up, and we're bound for separation. But then the Buddha tweaks it and sort of says, it's much more important to drop the world's bait and seek for peace. That's the encouragement. And not that we can't establish the roots of happiness and pay attention to how we bring about happiness, but we also say there's something more that we need to do. We have to learn how to be, to not be entangled, and to have the fruits of a peaceful heart to hand with us. So that recollection of cessation is it can be both an encouragement to brighten the mind with what is skillful and wholesome and leading to happiness, but also to encourage the mind to challenge it and say, yes, there is this cessation, and how can I be at peace with it? How can I not be shaken by anything that is of the nature to arise and cease? And this is the, on a certain level, this is the promise that the Buddha is giving, that in this human condition, with our body and mind, with the application of a path of practice, we can find a place of liberation, of freedom, of true peace. It's like the idiom that Ajahn Chah uses, which I find very beautiful. And it comes up most, well-known in a talk he gave to... He used it in other senses, but in a talk he gave to a person who was really on their deathbed, and speaking of our real home, because our real home is not the, if you want to find a real home, a real refuge, a real abiding place, it's not in body, which ages and sickens and dies. It's not in the mind that sort of, and our moods that change and shift. It's not in external circumstances. It's not in some kind of belief structure or a particular opinion that we or others hold. It's in this clear understanding of the true nature of things. And when we approach that, we open up the possibility of finding our real home. And it's not, say, way off in the distance somewhere, but it's sort of, contemplating cessation, I breathe in, contemplating cessation, I breathe out. Each in-breath, each out-breath, that truth is accessible. So that this contemplation of cessation, of nirodha. There's a very beautiful description of, it's in the Teri Gatha, so the verses of the elders and the verses of the one of the bhikkhunis, Pattacharla. And she's recounting the, what led to her liberation. And she'd been practicing, doing walking meditation. And I assume that she'd been doing it for a while. It wasn't just a one-off thing. It's completed her particular time on the walking path and then going into her dwelling place. And as is the case in ancient India and even in forest monasteries in Thailand, when you go into your dwelling place, you'll have some place for washing your feet. Because you're either you're barefoot or even... Even if not, then it's kind of dusty and dirty, so you wash your feet before going into a dwelling place. And you have a place for washing your feet. And in this case, it's probably some kind of a flat stone or something with a jar of water next to it. You take a dipper out and you pour the water onto your feet, wash your feet. And of course, water has a nature to flow and... She's watching the water flow away as she's washing her feet, of course, flowing away and then going into the ground. So it's ceasing. That stream of water is disappearing, ending, ceasing. And that brightened the mind. And then she went into her dwelling place, sat down to meditate, and putting out the lantern or her candle, and she said, just in the same way, plucking out the flame, she plucked out the last roots of ignorance. Just that cessation. There's a cessation on a mundane level. That's how all material phenomena move. That's the direction they're going in. But then there's also the opportunity for a cessation of ignorance, of the impediments. And that's actually also a translation of Nirodha. You think in terms of the nirodha, cessation as a, just on an external level, all that arises ceases. That's a truism. But what does that feel like? Like in the third noble truth, that's the noble truth of cessation. So that's pointing to cessation of suffering. Because it's actually it's a synonym for nibbana, so the cessation of suffering, cessation of stress, of limitation. And that's also how, say, an alternate translation to, say, cessation or ending is also like Nirodha. Ni is means without or free from. And then Rodha is a prison, confinement, impediment, so that without impediment, without confinement. That's the say the experiential level of cessation. It's an ending that is not just an annihilation, or an ending that is not just a getting rid of something. It's an ending that leaves us with an experience of freedom from impediment, freedom from obstacle, release from prison. Another aspect of cessation is also like non-arising. Like the non, rather than thinking you've got to go around and stamp out all the suffering, or you know, bring everything to cessation, and you realize, oh, it's just non-arising. Okay. So long as I don't, and come back that image of nutriment and feeding. Okay, so long as I'm not nourishing it, there's a non-arising, and therefore it's without impediment, without obstacle. So this aspect of cessation is an interesting theme to explore. As we practice, and just thinking, you know, as we're breathing in, there's the experience of just the cessation of the in-breath, the arising of the out-breath, cessation of the out-breath, arising of the in-breath. And there's these arisings and ceasings. And to... you know, to pay attention to the quality. I don't know about anybody else, but if in terms of the breath, it's sort of like that's a rising, it's a becoming, it's a movement somehow, and then the ending of the breath, cessation of breath, it's a settling, it's a coming to stillness, and we can tune into that. Coming to stillness, so that that feeling moves into our experience of through the meditation, also through the experience of thoughts, impressions, memories. So we don't have to be feeding them or following them or figuring them out or analyzing them. We can be attentive to their cessation. We can attend to their settling. You know, there's so much energy that we tend to invest in the movement of mind and the arising of particular thoughts and feelings and positions and perceptions. But in this, we can shift attention and pay attention to cessation, contemplating cessation. I breathe in, contemplating cessation, I breathe out. That's a very different feeling, very different result. And to experiment with that, play with it, see where it takes you. I think of a well-known quote of Ajahn Chah's, a very simple statement of what his motivation and what sustained his practice, his training, his quest. And he said, you know, one time he just said, I was looking for that which had an end to it. And you realize it's you know, so much of what we do is kind of endless. Which is, I mean, it's ordinary. I mean, you know, saying just because it's endless, it means you don't. Then you start fasting, and because you're fed up with it, it's just never ending. I have to eat all the time, but which is actually, I mean, that's part of it. That's a Jain, like a Jain position. It's like they're all they're totally into that kind of hardcore asceticism, and then. Kind of final liberation is only achieved when you stop eating and starve yourself to death. I mean, God, what kind of a liberation is that? But it's, some things, most things are endless, but we invest in them. So that just having a perspective that, this is the way it is. But I can attend to, I can look for that which has an end to it. Mm-hmm. I can find a place of peace within that. The last section of the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness and breathing is relinquishment, contemplating. Relinquishment, I breathe in, contemplating relinquishment, I breathe out. The Pali word is patinisaka. So it's a relinquishment in its general sense, but it's also a relinquishment of self, a relinquishment of the I position. Again, it's come up in several talks, and others have mentioned it, just how they the sense of that, the identification with the I, me, and mine process is the glue that holds our suffering together. And of course, the annihilation of self is just another self position. So that the relinquishment is a putting down what is a burden, so that the carrying around of both the being, becoming, needing to prop up a sense of me and mine is a burden, a kind of aversion. Impetus to try to get rid of. If I just got rid of this sense of self, is self-driven. So it's just the other side of the coin, and is just as entangling. In some senses, maybe even more painful. So that. But this relinquishment is more it's an act of incredible kindness to oneself, to put down what is a burden. Yeah, we can be incredibly dutiful in carrying burdens for ourselves. Just doing the right thing. But this is where the Buddha is saying, no, pay attention to the dukkha, pay attention to suffering, because that's when we'll start to put things down. And say, okay, this is burdensome, this is painful, this is complicated, this is difficult. Do I need to keep carrying it? No, I can put it down. It's like, there's this great story that Ajahn Jeff told me once of Ajahn Lee, his teacher's teacher. And Ajahn Lee was one of the early disciples of Ajahn Mun. And he was the first disciple of Ajahn Mun to go, let's say, come out of the northeast and go to central Thailand. And begin teaching in central Thailand. and he gained a following, and people were I mean, he was a wonderful teacher. But one of the things he would keep up in his practice is that he would, even though he was teaching in his monastery, he set up a monastery, teaching in Santa, he would go off wandering in, say, the Thai parlance, going tudong, and going off as a wandering monk, a monastic. And oftentimes he'd go up to the north. That was a favorite place, the north of Thailand. Lots of hills and forests and wild places and quiet places to practice. And for the most part, you know, the monks weren't known very well, so they could go up there and practice quietly. So he would do that. He'd disappear and go off on tudong, and the lay people were fascinated, inspired, and they requested, could he take them on tudong and sort of introduce them to tudong life and living out in the forest, practicing meditation. And I'm sure he thought about it for a while. I said, I don't know. But anyway, he relented, and he said, yes, yeah, okay. So he set up. They were all going to meet at the central train station in Bangkok and then take the train up to the north and go out in the forest and practice there. So they all meet at the train station, and of course, say, what a monk tends to have when they go on tudong is their alms bowl and then an umbrella with a mosquito net and other than that, they don't really have much, a couple odds and ends. And so they show up at the train station, and the lay people had bags and packs and boxes and extra food just in case they get hungry. And you know, I don't know if anybody had any pillows. You know, so anyway, they had a lot of stuff. And Ajahn Lee sort of took one look and said, okay, we're gathered. We're all together now to go on tudong. Let's go. He started walking along the train tracks. And people start picking their gear up and following him. You know, of course, it didn't take very long. I said, this is getting too heavy. Get rid of that. They got out to about Don Mueang, which is the old airport, about 25 kilometers, and it took about a day to get there. By that time, people had shed enough stuff. He said, okay, let's get on a train. So yeah, when it starts to be burdensome, you're happy to get rid of it. So you don't even think about it. Drop it by the wayside. So that's what we need to pay attention to that. Okay, is this burdensome? Ajahn Chah used to sort of say that, you know, sometimes, you know, like an investigation, because people will come with problems. You know, might be, say, some conflict that they're having or some difficulty with people or something, and go through the whole story of what they're feeling and experiencing, and you know, asking Ajahn Chah's advice of what to do. And he said, just look at it. And he said, is it worth it? And, you know, in Thai, I said, cool, mate. It's very simple. Is this really worth it? Do I need to be carrying this around? Is it worth it to invest so much energy in either planning and scheming to get this, or to plot my revenge, or come up with the way to get out of something? And is it worth it? Is it worth it? And that's where that relinquishment. I can let that go. And it's sort of like, yeah, dropping the world's bait, seeking for peace. Sort of a very clear understanding of I can drop this and I can be peaceful. And this is relinquishment. The relinquishment is not just out of getting rid of, annihilating, destroying. It's a real act of kindness. You see, it's a real act of compassion, but primarily to oneself, but often for everybody else around you as well. relinquishment. Contemplating relinquishment, I breathe in. Contemplating relinquishment, I breathe out. This path is one of the ways that the Buddha encourages us to reflect. Are we practicing in the correct way, or am I practicing in a wrong way? And the Buddha said, well, one of the signs of practicing in the correct way is that it's leading to relinquishment. One's happy to put things down. One's happy to let go. Because otherwise, there's this constant hanging on, grasping, clinging to things. So that paying attention. What's the feeling of that letting go? You're dropping the world's bait, seeking peace. So we can work with that this morning.